Imagine walking into your massive manufacturing plant tomorrow morning. The heavy machinery is just sitting there, totally silent.
Right.
The overhead lights are humming, but the floor is, well, it's completely empty. Your entire workforce has just vanished.
Poof, gone.
Exactly. Poof. And the moment you realize they've walked out, a timer starts ticking in your head. Because for every single hour those machines aren't running, your company is bleeding $50, maybe $100,000 in contractual penalties.
Yeah, it's a nightmare.
Right. The supply chain is backing up onto the loading dock, and you have major buyers who will, they'll drop your contracts by the end of the week if you fail to deliver.
Yeah.
So, what is your very first move?
It really is the ultimate nightmare scenario for any operations director. I mean, you are suddenly forced to figure out how to keep the heart of a business beating when the blood supply has just been completely cut off.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are exploring the extreme, really high-pressure world of contingency strike staffing. We're looking at how organizations survive massive sudden labor disruptions by stripping their complex operations down to the absolute bare metal.
It's fascinating stuff.
It really is. Our guide for this comes from a detailed operational manual created by Regional Supplemental Services, or RSS Inc., and it's titled Contingency Strike Staffing for Manufacturing Plants. And look, even if you never find yourself running a factory floor, understanding how a business survives this kind of trauma, well, it's a masterclass in risk management and operational resilience.
Absolutely. It applies to so many areas.
Okay, let's unpack this because my initial thought when I hear contingency staffing is just calling up a temp agency, like getting a substitute teacher to cover a class for a few days.
A lot of people make that exact
Yeah.
leap. But the reality on the ground, I mean, it couldn't be further from a standard temp job.
Really? How so?
Well, standard temporary staffing happens in a totally stable environment. You have a planned gap. Maybe someone goes on paternity leave for a month, right?
Yeah.
And you bring in a temp.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
They get a few days of role-specific training. The legal complexity is pretty minimal, and the environment is entirely calm. Plus, the regular staff is there to help them along.
Right. So the substitute teacher just reads the lesson plan that was left on the desk. The kids generally know how to behave, and the day just moves on.
Exactly the opposite of a strike scenario. Strike staffing happens under highly adversarial conditions. The timelines are completely compressed.
Like, how compressed are we talking?
Sometimes down to a matter of days. Facility access is heavily restricted, and the tension in the air is, well, it's palpable. Plus, you have no idea how long you're going to be operating like this.
Oh, wow. Yeah, because the strike could end tomorrow or in 6 months.
Exactly. It could be 3 days, it could be 3 months. So you aren't just busing in replacement workers. You are having to build a massive temporary governance layer practically overnight.
Governance, meaning like the rules of engagement.
Yeah, and the legal architecture. You need incredibly strict compliance protocols for how these temporary workers are classified. You need intense physical access control and a predefined command structure.
Right, so if something goes wrong.
And things will go wrong.
Oh.
Everyone needs to know exactly who makes the call.
So relying on the substitute teacher analogy really doesn't work at all here. Based on the RSS Inc. guide, trying to run a plant during a strike is more like trying to perform open heart surgery on a moving train.
That's a great way to put it.
While a team of federal regulators is standing over your shoulder analyzing every single slice of your scalpel.
That paints a much, much better picture. What's fascinating here is how the primary objective of the entire business has to immediately shift.
Shift how?
Well, when a plant activates a contingency strike plan, the goal is absolutely not to replicate normal operations perfectly.
Which, I mean, that feels totally counterintuitive. If I'm the factory owner and the workers strike, my gut instinct is to hire replacements and run that factory at full tilt.
Right, to prove a point.
Exactly. I want to prove to the union and to my clients that I don't need the regular guys and we haven't missed a single beat.
If ego's running the company, sure, that's what you do. But if risk management is running it, that's the quickest way to destroy your own facility.
Seriously, it's that dangerous.
Oh, absolutely. Attempting to sustain 100% normal production levels with a brand new, highly stressed workforce, it increases your operational risk exponentially. And it just doesn't deliver proportional value. It is incredibly dangerous to push a new system that hard. So instead, the objective becomes what the guide calls controlled continuity.
Controlled continuity, meaning you just, what, accept that you are going to make less product?
Yes, you deliberately recalibrate your output downward. You are no longer trying to maximize volume. You are just trying to maintain critical output, protect your physical machines from breaking, and stabilize your most important business obligations.
Okay, so you don't just hit the big red button and fly in a whole new workforce on a whim. There has to be a breaking point that justifies that level of disruption.
Oh, well, definitely.
What actually triggers an organization to initiate this massive, expensive operation?
It's rarely a panic move. It's usually triggered by very specific, predefined risk indicators. A total breakdown at the negotiating table where a strike is imminent is, you know, the obvious one.
Right, the classic scenario.
But it could also be partial workforce attrition. Say, a coordinated sick out that is creating massive bottlenecks in synchronized processes. If step two on the assembly line stops entirely,
then steps 3 through 10 are basically useless.
Exactly.
And the source material highlights the massive supply chain dependencies here. If you stop producing, the damage isn't just that you don't have a widget to sell today.
Right.
It's that you are suddenly getting hit with compounding financial penalties from your downstream buyers because you violated a service level agreement.
And that's exactly why, the moment those triggers are hit, leadership has to begin ruthless triage. They have to ask, who do we actually need in the building to save the patient?
So they aren't trying to replace every single worker one for one.
Not at all. They prioritize equipment operators, maintenance techs, because if a machine breaks now, it's a catastrophe. Quality control, safety supervisors, and logistics coordinators.
They strip the operation down to the absolute skeleton crew. But if you have a skeleton crew, how do you decide what actually gets made?
You prioritize high-margin products, or the specific orders you are legally contracted to deliver immediately. And you heavily reduce what's called SISKI complexity.
Meaning the different variations of a product, right?
Right. If your factory normally makes 14 different flavors of a beverage, during a strike, you might just run the line for your classic cola.
Ah, I see.
Think about the mechanics of that.
Yeah.
You don't have to stop the machines to change the labels, flush the pipes, or recalibrate the bottling pressure. You simplify the workflow so the new workers have fewer variables to manage.
That makes total sense.
You might also slow down the physical speed of the conveyor belts to accommodate their slower throughput.
Okay, so you slow things down, you simplify the products, you focus on survival. But slowing down the line doesn't magically make a heavy manufacturing plant safe.
No, it certainly doesn't.
You still have a building full of strangers in a dangerous environment. What happens when this controlled continuity slips out of control?
Well, the risks multiply quickly, and they are deeply layered. First, obviously, are the safety risks. Even if you simplify the tasks, you still have inexperienced personnel operating industrial machinery.
Right, and one wrong button press can cause severe injury.
Exactly. Then you have quality degradation. If the new crew doesn't understand the tiny, undocumented nuances of how a machine behaves, the product quality gets wildly inconsistent.
And if you ship bad product, you're damaging your brand long after the strike ends.
Huge reputational impact.
But the guide also harps heavily on the legal exposure. It emphasizes that missteps in labor law compliance or misclassifying these temporary workers can trigger massive penalties.
This is a huge trap for companies. It comes down to co-employment and worker classification.
Meaning, like, who actually employs them?
Right. Are these replacement workers independent contractors? Are they employees of the staffing agency? If your floor manager starts giving them certain types of direct disciplinary orders, the government might suddenly rule that your company is a joint employer.
Oh, wow. I never even thought of that.
Yeah. And doing that during an active union dispute can trigger National Labor Relations Board violations that give the union massive leverage at the negotiating table.
So you're navigating this insane legal minefield under intense external scrutiny while a literal protest is happening in your parking lot.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Which brings up the security element. How do you physically secure a plant against unauthorized access or sabotage without making the place look like a heavily militarized fortress? Because if you broaden private security and start throwing up barbed wire, doesn't that just pour gasoline on the fire with the picketers outside?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that is the exact tightrope the RSS Inc. guide warns about. Security teams must operate with absolute precision and restraint.
Restraint is key there, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. Overreach escalates the tension and gives the union great photos for the evening news. But under preparation exposes your facility to people disrupting the operation.
So how do they balance it?
By relying on structure rather than just muscle. You establish very controlled, separate entry points. You verify credentials away from the main conflict zones. You use a lot of passive surveillance cameras rather than guards and riot gear.
Got it. Keep it calm, but secure.
Right. And most importantly, you rely heavily on communication discipline across the whole company.
Right. The internal versus external messaging.
It has to be ironclad. Internally, to the workers on the floor, communication must be ruthlessly factual. Here are the safety reminders. Here are today's targets. Here is your role. No politics.
And externally?
Externally, to your clients and the public, you are managing customer expectations and brand positioning. If your operations manager says one thing to a worker and your PR team says another to the press, you undermine your authority and drastically increase your operational risk.
Okay, so let's put the pieces together here. You've secured the perimeter calmly. You've locked down your messaging. The temporary workforce has arrived from the agency, but now you have a factory full of people who don't actually know the quirks of your specific facility.
Right. They're stepping in blind.
Exactly. How in the world do you teach them to safely run a complex plant before something explodes? You don't have 6 weeks to put them through a standard corporate onboarding program.
You don't even have 6 days. Often you have 48 hours.
48 hours. That's insane.
It is. Which means your entire approach to training has to be fundamentally gutted and rebuilt. You prioritize speed, physical safety, and basic functional competence. You completely abandon the idea of completeness. You do not try to teach them the entire job.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me. The RSS guide breaks down this accelerated 48-hour bootcamp approach into a four-phase onboarding model, and it is brutally efficient.
Walk through how they structure it.
So phase one is rapid orientation. And we're not talking about like a PowerPoint on the company's core values or a video on the history of the founder.
Oh, definitely not.
They literally walk the floor and point out the safety zones. They say, here are the emergency exits and here's the red line on the floor. If you cross it while the machine is on, you will die. Stay out of there.
Very direct.
Exactly. Phase two is task-specific instruction, a hands-on demo of exactly what they will be doing and absolutely nothing else.
Right.
Phase three involves them working their initial shifts under intense over-the-shoulder supervision with instant feedback. And then phase four is a gradual reduction of that supervision as they prove they won't break the machine.
Think about the psychology of that. What are they intentionally leaving out of that process?
Bloated employee handbooks, the massive binders of standard operating procedures.
All of it. The documentation is simplified to the extreme because in a high-stress, unfamiliar environment, overloading a new worker with excessive procedural detail actually increases their error rate.
Oh, I see.
Their cognitive load is already maxed out. So you teach them core task execution, not full role mastery.
It reminds me of the kitchen brigade system in a really high-end restaurant.
How so?
Well, when the executive chef hires a brand new prep cook, they don't sit them down on day one and teach them the whole menu. They don't explain the subtle flavor profile of the signature dish.
Right.
They hand the new guy a knife. They show him the exact safe way to chop an onion. And they say, chop these onions perfectly over and over again until I tell you to stop.
That's a great way to visualize it. And in this manufacturing context, that onion chopper is designated as a core operator. They're given one primary limited production task. But a factory can't run on just onion choppers.
No, of course not.
If that's all you have, the system is incredibly fragile. To make that work, you need a very specific, layered workforce model surrounding them.
Because if the core operator drops his knife or his machine jams, he doesn't know how to fix it and the whole line just stops.
Exactly. This is where the layered model saves the day. You have your core operators on the line. Above them, you have what are called floaters. These are highly experienced, cross-trained personnel who can jump in to fill gaps or relieve bottlenecks instantly.
So they are the sous chefs. They actually know the whole menu.
Yes, exactly. If a core operator is struggling to keep pace, the floater steps in and takes over for 20 minutes to clear the backlog.
Okay, that makes sense.
Above the floaters, you have supervisors providing constant direction. You have technical specialists whose only job is to handle complex maintenance and troubleshoot the machines when they jam.
Right.
And then you have dedicated safety leads who aren't touching the product at all. Their only job is monitoring compliance and pulling people back from those red kill zones we talked about.
It's a brilliant matrix because it completely reduces the dependency on any single worker. If one core operator makes a mistake, the floater steps in, the tech specialist resets the machine, the supervisor adjusts the workflow, and the safety lead ensures nobody gets hurt in the chaos. It allows for real-time dynamic adjustments.
It is an incredibly resilient structure when executed well. But, as you can probably guess, building that layered matrix of highly specialized roles overnight is astronomically expensive.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the math on this. The level of intense over-the-shoulder supervision, the specialized rapid training, the round-the-clock security flying in these tech specialists, the financial burn rate must be staggering.
It is a massive capital expenditure. The cost model goes so far beyond just paying the hourly wages of the replacement worker.
What else goes into it?
We have immense sourcing and mobilization expenses. Literally, chartering flights and securing hotels to move a vetted workforce across the country in a matter of days. You have the overhead of that dense supervisory layer we just talked about. You have the security enhancements, and you are paying top dollar for constant legal and compliance oversight.
Plus, the hidden cost of lost productivity. Because even with the best training, these new workers are going to be significantly slower during the ramp-up phase. You are essentially paying a premium to produce less.
You are. But leadership has to weigh those immense, painful costs against the alternative. What is the true cost of absolute operational downtime?
It's a lot more than just the daily payroll.
Exactly. It's the immediate loss revenue, yes. But it's also the contractual penalties for missing your shipments, the loss of market share to competitors who swoop in, and the permanent damage to customer relationships if they realize your company can't guarantee delivery during a crisis.
So let's say a company weighs all that, swallows the cost, and decides to activate the plan. They have the layered model, the security protocols, the simplified training. Why do these contingency plans ever fail? Because we've all seen headlines where a strike happens and a company still completely falls apart.
This is perhaps the most crucial takeaway from the RSS Inc. guide. In crisis operations, the frontline rarely fails the plan. The plan fails the frontline.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, failures in strike staffing are almost always rooted in planning gaps long before the strike ever started, not in execution errors by the workers on the day. It's leadership underestimating the complexity of what they're trying to do.
Planning gaps. Give me a concrete example of how a plan fails the frontline.
Misallocated labor is a huge one. Imagine a company flying in 100 highly paid, specialized replacement workers, getting them past the picket line, and then realizing they didn't properly map out which roles were actually critical. Yeah. They put too many people on the packing line, but have no one who knows how to operate the forklift to move the pallets. Or worse, inadequate supervisory depth.
Meaning not enough managers.
Right. You bring in all these workers, but you only have two supervisors in the building who know how to turn on the proprietary software that runs the floor. You've essentially just built a very expensive parking lot.
Wow. The source also points to weak coordination between internal departments like legal, HR, and operations, which makes sense if ops is screaming to run the machines faster to meet a quota, but legal hasn't finished verifying the worker classifications, the whole thing grinds to a halt while they fight in a conference room.
And that leads right into the most common failure point.
Yeah.
Overambitious production targets. When executive management refuses to accept the reality of controlled continuity, when they refuse to scale back their output expectations and push a newly built stressed system too hard, the system shatters.
So what does this all mean? If you're listening to this right now and you're thinking, well, I don't run a heavy machinery plant, so I don't need a strike plan. This concept of evaluating your operational readiness still seems universally applicable.
This raises an important question for any listener. The guide outlines a readiness framework that any organization in any industry can adapt. It forces you to ask fundamental questions about your own team.
Like what?
Are your critical roles truly mapped out? If your key people disappear tomorrow, do you know exactly what functions must survive to keep the lights on? Can your onboarding process be executed in a compressed timeline? Are your compliance and operational requirements documented clearly enough that a competent stranger could step in and follow them safely?
And if the answer to those questions is no, you have a massive planning gap, which is exactly why specialized agencies like RSS Inc. exist in the first place. They aren't just a body shop sending over a bus full of temps. They're providing the entire architectural solution to that planning gap.
Correct. They maintain pre-vetted pools of workers who already understand manufacturing environments. But more importantly, they bring the rapid deployment models, they bring their own on-site supervisory structures, and they integrate the legal and compliance oversight directly into the operational plan for you.
So they basically take the wheel.
They act as the stabilizing force, ensuring that the deployed personnel actually solve the crisis rather than adding to the chaos.
It's an incredible logistical feat When you step back and look at the whole picture, contingency strike staffing really is a masterclass in extreme triage.
It really is.
It's about recalibrating your ego and your expectations downward, stripping away everything that isn't absolutely essential to survival. You distill training down to the bare safety critical functions. You build a deeply layered workforce so that no single point of failure can take down the system. And you manage severe legal and security risks with absolute unflinching discipline.
And, you know, the true test of any complex organization, whether it's a factory floor, a hospital, or a tech startup, is not how efficiently it operates when the sun is shining and the primary engine is humming along perfectly.
Right. It's easy to look good when things are normal.
Exactly. The true test is how it functions when that primary engine is suddenly violently removed. Can your organization achieve controlled continuity, or does it immediately collapse into chaos?
It really makes you evaluate your own daily workflows. And it leaves me with one final thought to mull over. We've just spent this time exploring how a massive, highly regulated manufacturing plant can successfully distill its complex operations down to just the absolute essentials.
Mm-hmm.
They manage to strip away the bloated documentation, they radically simplify their workflows, and they successfully cross-train a completely new workforce in a matter of days, all while operating under the intense adversarial pressure of a labor crisis.
It's a remarkable achievement of focus.
It is, but it begs the question. If large organizations are capable of being that ruthlessly efficient, that clear in their communication, and that focused on core output when their backs are against the wall, why are standard day-to-day corporate operations so often incredibly slow, bloated, and inefficient?
That's a very fair point.
What could our regular, calm, everyday businesses learn from the ruthless efficiency of a crisis response team?
Now, that is a provocative thought to leave you with.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep asking those hard questions, look critically at your own operations, and we will catch you next time.